Without further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Professor Gary Dowsett. Gary is the Deputy Director of Arches and he is a renowned sociologist. He has published extensively in the areas of sexuality and HIV, and he is author, co-author or co-editor of 6 books, more than 80 book chapters and over 90 other publications. His first book was voted as one of the top 10 most influential books in Australian sociology, and he has worked as a consultant and advisor to the World Health Organization, the United Nations Development Program, as well as UNAIDS. And he's also a fellow of the Academy of the Social Sciences in Australia. Please join me in welcoming Professor Gary Dowsett.
Okay. So I wanted to start off with the notion of the confusion that exists in our fields of gender and sexuality studies between the primary concepts of gender and sexuality. And in the abstract for this, you'll see that I noted some of those confusions. And I wanted to give you 4 examples of how these confusions operate in fairly practical ways in the work that we do, and then move on to discuss some other things. So the first example occurred last week. Arches is part of a collaborative research network with the University of New England, funded by the federal government for the last 4 years, to build capacity at the University of New England, particularly in gender and sexuality studies. And Arches is primarily the partner in building the sexuality studies side of UNE's capacity. So as part of that contract, I went up there last week to do some workshops with the early career researchers and some junior researchers on the staff and to present some papers. And in the middle of a workshop on thinking about where UNE might go in building sexuality research, given their really great start under the CRN, I posed some questions for small group discussion about where you might build a research agenda. And I used a matrix to do this, which I won't tell you about necessarily, but one of the axes on the matrix was, what do you think about international issues that could be a sexuality research area, national issues that could be, and regional issues, given UNE's focus on regional issues in the New England area of Australia. And we went around the group, there were some great ideas, and one group came up with the idea that we should do some work on misogyny and gender-based violence. Now this was the day after, I can't remember which, that Malcolm Turnbull announced the big initiative on gender violence in Australia, so it was one of those great coincidences at the moment. But my question was, that's not a sexuality issue, that's a gender issue. And there was a bit of consternation in the room at the time, and we bandied around a bit of an argument for a period of time, and had quite a good discussion. But we actually kind of did come to the conclusion that the theoretical and conceptual way in which gender-based violence is thought about in Australia is actually through the lens of gender, even if sexuality might be part of gender-based violence issues in relation to, say, sexual violence in particular. But the lens that we actually use is a gendered lens, not actually a sexuality theory lens. And there was general consensus by the end of that discussion among the group that, yeah, that's actually right, isn't it? So why do we suddenly get a little bit confused here about what the lens is we're using, what the primary focus might be? So I think that's one example of where these confusions can turn up. The second is in HIV/AIDS. I've been working in AIDS since the beginning of the epidemic, and this centre is a national HIV research centre for the federal government. So we've done a lot of work in this field in Australia and overseas. So I want to mention a couple of issues in AIDS that reflects where there's confusion between gender and sexuality. And the first is in the notion of key populations. Now, some of you may know not what this term means. It used to be called high-risk groups. I think you've probably all heard of that term. But now it's called key populations because we don't call them high-risk groups anymore because that's not nice. And as key populations, of course, gay men in our country, Australia, and in many Western countries or in the global north, but also what's now called men who have sex with men, MSM is the acronym, are one of the key populations. This term, MSM, was actually developed in the late 80s and became part of UN policy. It was a British idea in the first place, but it didn't actually exist in epidemiology or social research until the late 80s, early 90s. And the idea was to move away from gay men, which was seen as an identity category, that is a bunch of people who were a subcultural form in the West, to a set of practices that were risky in relation to the transmission of the virus. So it was to try to take attention away from the people and therefore the possibilities of persecution, marginalisation, which was being experienced by gay men at that time, to the practices and almost in a sense take the practices away from the people and turn them into something like a behaviour. And that was where we should focus if we were going to deal with the virus. The problem was it actually denuded all the cultural meanings related to sex between men in all countries around the world. They all suddenly became the same practice. Anal intercourse is anal intercourse is anal intercourse. It's just the same thing. And of course it isn't. All around the world in different places has different meanings, legal statuses and various other things. So it actually robbed something really significant from our understanding of sexuality. But it did more than that. After a while it became a reified category. And now in many countries in Asia you'll hear people talk about themselves as I am an MSM. Or MSMs do this and do that. As if it's become a real category of social typologies in countries where it was only meant to describe a practice that was related to risk. It's turned into an identity. And even AMFAR, the American Foundation for Research on AIDS, now has a category called GMT, which is gay men who have sex with men, and transgender, which is confuses actually gender categories with sexual practices and sexual identities, all in the same category as if it's a transmission category. It also got so ridiculous that at one point we had men who had sex with men, men who had sex with women, men who had sex with men and women, and when you add all that together, it's simply men who had sex. So this whole concept of thinking about the sexual transmission of a virus ended up in the gender category men. And we can see yet a confusion here about what you're actually dealing with when you're trying to deal with the epidemic. Finally, largely at the instigation of gay activists, transgender women finally got on the agenda of HIV. They had been left off for many, many, many years, even though transgender women were at high risk and very vulnerable to HIV in many countries. But immediately, the transgender activists were clumped in with men who have sex with men. And so we got an MSMTG category to work with. Now, of course, many transgender activists don't like the fact that they're lumped into the... Well, transgender women in particular don't like the fact that they're lumped in with gay men, because they're not men. On the other hand, where were they to go? Because the women and women involved in HIV, particularly those with a liberal feminist position, did not want transgender women being aligned with women. They were following a particular kind of feminist politics that regard transgender people as not actually women. And those of you who know the debates concerning Sheila Jeffries and that form of radical feminism here in Australia and elsewhere would see the long history of that refusal to think about transgender women as being women. And that's very pervasive in the United Nations. So here you see a set of politics and confused conceptual categories actually not working well to think about research and transmission of HIV. Particularly in populations in the Asian region where this is more pertinent. The third I want to mention is the idea of SOGI, S-O-G-I, sometimes called SOGI and sometimes called SOGI. What that stands for in the United Nations system is sexual orientation and gender identity. And this has emerged as a single term for populations around the world for which there needs to be a United Nations policy in relation to human rights, sexual health, you name what it is. Now, I was at a consultation in WHO on a document called Sexual Health, Human Rights and the Law, which has just been released a couple of months ago by the World Health Organization, and I was getting a bit cross with this sexual orientation, because everybody that was gay, lesbian or bisexual was suddenly, and only those three, lumped in the category of sexual orientation, as that is the only issue in which LGB populations have to deal with in the world, is questions of their orientation being recognised. There used to be three categories in medical science: sexual orientation, sexual identity and sexual preference, and they represented different aspects of sexual life. Suddenly, we were reduced to sexual orientation, that is, the object choice, same or opposite gender, object choice, and that's all that that actually refers to in the literature. That's all we are, and that's only that what we are in terms of the United Nations. My colleague, a transgender man colleague from Brazil, Mauro, got up and said, well, you know, gender identity is not the only thing that the trans people actually think about. That's not the only reason why we're persecuted. We have many other issues on the agenda than our identity. But trans identity or gender identity had been borrowed from the DSM, from mental health nomenclature, as being the only category of medical problem related to trans people. So what the UN had done after 20 years of LGBT politics had simply reduced all of that activism to two categories that had come from the old Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Diseases, sexual orientation and gender identity, and reduced all of those questions to those two categories. And one's a sexuality issue and one's a gender issue, primarily, and then collapsed them together into one category called SOGI. It just goes to show the muddled thinking that we're getting at those highest levels on these sorts of issues. And the last one I want to mention is the notion that gender equals women. And this is a really long-standing fight in gender politics. It's a particularly big fight in health. If you think about the way in which gender equality is often talked about, it's almost always talked about as men having unequal access to resources, the patriarchal dividend, as Raymond Connell calls it, compared with women. Yet there are many other axes of inequality in our society in which gender doesn't function in the same way. Yet when we think about gender, that inequality only works in one direction. If you think about gender-based violence, it's exactly the same deal. It's men's violence against women. No one ever thinks about women's violence against boys, for example. Parents, school teachers, nuns in school perpetrating violence against boys. Gender-based violence is actually relational, but it's not thought about that way. Women are primarily seen as the victims in that way. And the other thing about this kind of way of thinking about gender is it's primarily focused on problems of heterosexuality. Once you set up the axis of gender as being only the relations between men and women, you then can only deal with the issues of heterosexuality and particularly heteronormativity as a problematic version of heterosexuality as your focus. It really restricts what you can do. So there are four ways in which gender as it's currently constituted and sexuality sit in a really misaligned or poorly aligned formulation in different fields. They've been historically produced through different forces and dealing with different issues, but they bear that same relationship to each other of this misalignment of gender and sexuality. There are many others, but I'm going to leave that there just as four examples of that confusion and move to the next section, which I'm going to talk briefly, rethinking gender. Because one of the ways that this problem could be dealt with is to rethink the gender side of the argument and where you might go. And I want to mention a couple of things here. One is Donna Haraway, most famously known, of course, for her cyborg theories. But Donna Haraway was asked quite a while ago to write an entry for a German encyclopedia on sex and gender. This is a number of years ago, and she's written this up in an essay that I can give you the reference for if you'd like later on. And she came across a problem, because in German, there is no different word between sex and gender. It is exactly the same word. And that is also true in Spanish, and it's true in Italian. And she grappled with how she was going to try and find a way to write about the way English as a language deals with the difference, and we have different ways of dealing with this in English, a number of different ways, the difference between sex and gender, or sexuality and gender, when the language of another culture does not actually have that conceptualization bolted down inside the vocabulary itself. And it raises very interesting questions in terms of our work in developing gender and sexuality theory of how much this is Anglo-American theory, English language-based theory, and how difficult it is to translate the facility with which we use gender, sexuality in English language theory in thinking how that can actually translate into other cultures and other places in analysing their circumstances. So I think that poses one example of the difficulties that we face. The second I want to come to is Gail Rubin, who in 1975 most famously came up with the idea of the sex/gender system, and what is one of the great, great essays of sexuality theory in the world. Now, Rubin is an anthropologist. And she was struggling with ways of looking at phenomena inside an anthropological setting where you could see both sexuality operating as a set of practices and ideas and gender, as she understood it, operating, intersecting in some way. But she could see their relationship, but she could also identify them as different components. So this was her go at a sex-gender system, and it became a very important move at that time. But by 1984, less than 9 years later, Rubin recanted on this particular attempt. And she argued very, very strongly at that time that this particular manoeuvre on her part lost sight of sexuality, and that the only way we were going to be able to investigate sexuality as a field of study in social phenomenon within our fields in the social sciences or elsewhere is if we conceptually separated sexuality and gender as two distinct fields. Irrespective of their relationship and intersection, we need to think about them as two distinct fields, and by focusing on sexuality as a distinct field, we may rethink that relationship with gender and rethink the way in which we think about sexuality inside gender. That's really one of, that's another very famous essay. It's called Rethinking Sex. And that really starts the beginning of a field called critical what's now called critical sexuality studies, sometimes just sexuality studies, and I'll come back to that field a little later on. But it's a very important moment in declaring out loud that we needed to do something different. Two other people I'll mention who've tried to reposition sexuality and gender. The first is Raewyn Connell, probably Australia's most cited and famous sociologist, and probably one of the great gender theorists in this country. And Raewyn had long been concerned with the way liberal feminism in the 60s and 70s had positioned gender as really a study of sex roles, historically produced sex roles, which people then grow up and inhabit as they go along, and had been criticising sex role theory, its origins in Parsonian sociology, and this the way it had been adopted by liberal feminism. And so in her work, particularly in a book called Gender and Power, and later in another major book called Masculinities, Raewyn tried to reshape gender as a structure of relations rather than a structure of roles, in which women and men are constantly negotiating daily relationships inside structures that have been historically produced but get reproduced only through our own actions. So it's something that we are agents in producing ourselves every day. We get up and reproduce systems and change them by our very actions. And she determined there were three areas in which these relations operated. One was the division of labour, not just the domestic division of labour, but also the division of labour in the economy. The second was structures of power inside societies themselves, through hierarchies of violence, the operation of the state, the use of coercion in histories and cultures in which women and men are brought into relationship with each other in all sorts of ways and negotiate those relations of power. And the third was the patterning of object choice, or emotions and desire, the way our emotions and our sexual object choices get sorted for us and how we relationally produce those as another place in which gender operates. You can see in this manoeuvre an attempt by Connell to get what we would now call sexuality into the structure of gender as one of the three places in the organisation of society where sexuality has a place. So we see sexuality coming into gender theory in this manoeuvre, but it sits as a component or a constituent or an ingredient of a larger structure of gender itself. And that's the parting of the ways which I have with Raewyn. Raewyn was my PhD supervisor, by the way. So that's the parting of the ways that we have about that particular theoretical manoeuvre on her part. But it significantly did shift the theory of gender and some shift in the theory of sexuality at the time. The second person is Judith Butler, whom a number of you will be aware of, who made a different kind of a manoeuvre in relation to gender, but in some sense is not dissimilar to Connell's manoeuvre, in that Connell was trying to find something relational and dynamic and agentive that people do rather than inherit, as in sex role theory. And Butler uses the notion of performativity here, and I'm not going to go into a long detail about that, but it really is a similar kind of argument about drawing on history and culture, that we come with our history and culture behind us. We tend to repeat it, she calls it citationality, but we also contest it at the same time. And at the moment of our contestation, we in fact both embed old practices and invent new practices at the same time. And so gender, in a sense, rolls on. What I think is more difficult about Butler is that the human being actually doing this kind of disappears. The human being becomes a kind of object constituted by history and power. And she really doesn't understand the nature of daily practice, which Connell really focuses on, but they both actually try to move gender away from gender role theory and to create some space in which us and our bodies manoeuvre. There is, however, a little lack of sexuality in Butler's notion. She's often thought of as the early queer theorist, but she really doesn't do much work on sexuality itself. It just sits in there somewhere in the manoeuvre that goes along. So those two were, I think, really important attempts to reconfigure gender so that we could think about how it might intersect with sexuality and find a place to put it together. There are many others, Rosemary Pringle's work, lots of people here in Australia and elsewhere, but I'm not going to go through those now. I just wanted to give you those two examples of attempts to move in that direction. But where in these really, is my question, where is sexuality? Where is it, as Rubin's claim, we have to set up a separate field? And I'd argue that part of the problem here is the question of origins. And by that I mean, what are the discursive and philosophical and scientific backgrounds that come to produce the field of sexuality as we understand it at the moment? Where did they come from? These, and I'm going to do three of these, I'll explain three of these at the moment. These are not dissimilar to the intellectual work over the last 150 years that has produced gender as we know it. They run in parallel and they cross over at various times. But I'm just trying to isolate the historical and conceptual manoeuvres that come, that focus on sexuality. And the first of these is the scientific field of sexology. Now, sexology probably originates in about the 1850s, 1860s. It really comes to prominence toward the end of the 19th century in the work of people like Carl Maria Kurt Benny, the man who invented the word homosexual, Kraft Ebbing and Havelock Ellis, who do the first taxonomies of sexual practices and sexual activities that people participate in. In a sense, they produce encyclopedias of sexual activities, particularly the sexual activities they didn't think were normal. And this is a very important moment because this is the moment of the constitution of the unnormal in sexuality studies at the late end of the 19th century. The first unnormal being the naming of the homosexual. So this particular science starts to produce some categories with which we pull sexuality out from simply meaning the sexual reproduction of the species to being a kind of people, a kind of action, a kind of practice. Sexology runs on through the 19th century, still very prominent today. Leading up to, I probably think, the major moment that people are interested in right now, watching The Masters of Sex on television, Masters and Johnson themselves, who are nowhere as good looking as the two people who act their roles, I can tell you when you look at their photographs. And what we'll get to while we get to Masters and Johnson is actually turning sex into something that you can investigate via the microscope. Is the people have nothing to do with it whatsoever. So they put people in labs, they wore their white coats for respectability, they put cameras up vaginas and anuses, and they watched people having sex and tried to figure out what was going on. The most unique scientific fact they found is that the internal walls of the vagina change colour during arousal. I'll leave it there. No one knows why, and no one knows what to do with it or what it means, but it does, yeah? And they did the stage theory of arousal that you probably all heard about. You sort of start here and you get horny and then you feel, you know, tired and have a cigarette at the end, that kind of stuff. But that kind of, that kind of way of theorising kind of fell into disrepute for a while, but it's having a major resurgence at the moment. And I think it's one we all need to watch carefully. And this is happening in biology and neuroscience, neuropsychology, as well as neurobiology, and in endocrinology and genetics, where there's major advances in rethinking the functioning of the body, the functioning of hormones, the functioning of synapses, the way in which pleasure systems and sites of the brain work in relation to bodies in a particular way. Really, really challenging work for social scientists like us to rethink the contribution of the body in constituting sexuality in some particular kind of way. And if I give you just one example of a really interesting new book you might have seen reviewed, Mark Lewis's book on sex and addiction and drugs, which just came out recently. If you read that, he doesn't really deal with sex addiction and porn addiction, except he lays down a series of propositions about the possibility of neuroplasticity and sex addiction and porn addiction, which tries to dispute the idea that addiction is a disease. And it's a really interesting challenge to those of us that have used medical models in the past to deal with these things. So it's just one way in which neuroscience is actually producing challenges in relation to the body. The second area, that's sexology. The second area is sex research. And sex research starts with the same people, the taxonomies of Kraft Ebbing and Havelock Ellis, but actually starts to move as a result of the invention of contemporary population statistics at the end of the 19th century, and eventually, particularly the invention of computing in the middle of the 20th century and large-scale computing toward the end of the 20th century, to use the methodology of a survey to find out what people are doing. The big, big moment, the breakthrough moment, of course, is Kinsey and his colleagues in 1948 with the study on men and 1953 with the study on women, which basically blew out of the water everybody's idea about what was going on in people's bedrooms and behind sheds and under trees in America. It frightened the horses terribly in America, and it frightened everybody else around the world as well. It was enormously controversial, methodologically flawed, but it really showed the power of that kind of way of understanding human sexual behaviour with this kind of new methodology. And this particular industry inside academia and also in commercial world has just gone out of control over the last 50 years. When you think about the number of surveys of sex that are done all around the country at the moment, this very centre in doing ASHA 1 and ASHA 2, our big national sex surveys, are absolutely complicit in this industry of monitoring and understanding behavioural practices, sexual practices among people, and quantifying them. And the big manoeuvre in the quantifying that comes along from sexology is the quantifying of the normal and therefore the consolidation of the categories of the unnormal. Because what do statistics do? They produce norms, statistical norms. And it's a very small manoeuvre to go from a statistical norm to what is normal inside a culture and inside a moral system or a system of set of beliefs. And that's exactly the manoeuvre that happened during the 20th century. Statistical norms of behaviour got turned into the normal, and the outliers got turned into the unnormal, and were sought more and more and more in these kinds of surveys in order to constitute them as areas of knowledge and of labelling. And if you think of our work and everybody else's work on HIV/AIDS since the epidemic began 30 years ago, the huge industry of doing sexual behaviour surveys all around the world of gay men, MSM, sex workers, young people in schools, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of studies over 30 years of sexual behaviour, constituting a level of surveillance of human sexual behaviour that we have never, ever seen before in the history of the planet, has been constituted by sex research as a particular way of knowing what sexuality is. That is, a pattern of practices in majoritarian and minoritarian forms, in normal and unnormal forms. And that is probably now the most pervasive way in which societies understand the sexual lives of their populations, and which most of us get to judge who we are when we fill in one of those questionnaires. Now, the third area is critical sexuality studies, which is I mentioned a little bit earlier, and this is the field that I work in and have helped build, actually, in my career. This really starts in 73 with a book called Sexual Conduct by William Simon and John Gagnon. Gagnon had actually worked at the Kinsey Institute, so you start to see the lineage of some of these works coming in together. Gagnon is still alive. Unfortunately, Bill Simon is dead. They came up with the idea of sexual scripts. Excuse me. Sexual scripts were an attempt to say that we're born into histories and cultures which have ideas about how we're supposed to be and behave sexually. And some of these come at an interpersonal level, some of them come at a kind of psychological sense of self-personality level, and some are also cultural preferences about the way in which sex should behave. This was incredibly influential because it really started what is now seen as the beginning of theories of the social construction of sex. That sex actually moved from being something that the body generates through the biology of reproduction to something that society defines, choreographs, and builds for you as a set of possibilities in the way that you might live a sexual life, the way you might enjoy the pleasures of sex in the culture and the society that you're in. It was a very, very powerful moment to shift the locus of attention away from bodies and types of people, and particularly the unnormal types of people, to societies and cultures actually combining to give us an idea. Very, very quickly, Gagnon and Simon's work was overtaken and incorporated into second wave feminist theories of gender and initially sexuality. But more importantly, it built really quickly into the early days of gay and lesbian theory, which became in the 70s and the 80s one of the major places in which new sexuality theory was being developed, building from Gagnon and Simon's scripting theory, sometimes without knowing it, but really starting to think about the way in which societies configure sexuality and the way in which sexualities function in society on a day-to-day basis. And I want you to keep that thought in your mind. How do sexualities function in the day-to-day bases of societies operating? Because I'm going to come back to that at the end. This eventually transformed into queer theory, and then split into many, many different directions under the guise of queer theory, and that's probably where the best work is still being done globally in the world today. It did have in the middle of it an interactionist turn, borrowing from symbolic interactionism, which is a North American sort of sociological approach. And the two key people here are Ken Plummer and Diane Richardson, both English, ironically, because almost everybody else who's a symbolic interactionist is American. But Ken's work and Diane's work in the 70s and the 80s, and Ken's still writing at the moment, although he's retired, really tried to understand sexuality as a way, as something that grows in the nature of our relations with each other, in which we borrow from history, society, culture, possibilities, all sorts of ways of constituting ourselves and our relationships in our interactions with each other. They struggled with the way sex and power fit together, but really take that on board very carefully, and Ken's later work does that very, very well. And this area is still really a very productive area of trying to think through sexuality at small levels as well as at large levels, at the level of society. It brings history and culture and power back into the frame, and it makes sex agentive again. It's not just something we have to do because we're biologically wired to do so. It actually starts to involve issues of individual decision-making in the context of history and culture. And a lot of our work here at Arches really fits into this framework. A lot of our theoretical backgrounds come from here. A lot of our more qualitative work fits in this framework. And the new, those of you know that colleagues and I have a new ARC discovery grant called Muscling Up, which is about the sexualization of men's bodies, what we're doing over the next 3 years here at Arches. And that is going to be coming from that particular perspective. In a sense, what we're trying to do there is ask the question, how might gender service sexuality? Rather than the question to date, which has been, how is sexuality servicing gender as one part of the structure of gender? By turning that question on its head, how might gender service sexuality? We're hoping to open up some questions in relation to men and sexual performance and bodies in Australia today. The context of all of this work, if you like, the politics of this field, is a appeal of persecution. Kinsey was persecuted the moment he brought his study out, and the Kinsey Institute and the consequence of all of this work, the International Academy of Sex Research, of which I'm a member, have been harassed every time they've met around the globe at any meeting by the religious right from the United States. There is absolutely still persecution going on against this kind of sex research. The same thing happens at this centre. We constantly get complaints about our surveys at times, even though they passed all of the ethics rules and committees, because we shouldn't be asking those questions. And in the critical sexuality studies area, we manage to fly a bit below the radar because we're often working with small populations rather than large public and publicised research studies. But there's quite a lot of concern about queer studies and about funding sexuality research, both in this country and, of course, in the United States. Perhaps more so during the Bush era and the Howard era in Australia, but we've still got to wait to see what happens under the new magic Turnbull era to see whether sexuality will be allowed in some form. There's also now a vast industry with sex is totally focused on. An industry, whether it's the porn industry, the sex toys industry, selling cars or holidays, you name it. Sex is in there everywhere. It's such a big industry, sex therapy. That the context in which we're trying to understand what's going on for people sexually are basically so big, they blow out of control all the time. And the classic example is AIDS, where we've looked at 30 million people being infected around the world. But nothing this big has happened before sexually on the planet's history. And it's really shown us that we're working in an arena which looks sort of interpersonal and private and secretive, which is now kind of global and public and huge in a way that wasn't there 30, 40 years ago. So I think it shows this sexuality deserves to be a field on its own for a number of reasons. So Ruben got what she wants. We actually do have a field of sexuality studies, but it's not necessarily all going well. This is my last section. Excuse me. Firstly, there are challenges. One of the major challenges is how we think about the body. Sex research and critical sexuality studies has been pretty abhorrent and boring in the way it thinks about the body, and the sexologists have been totally obsessed with the body. I could give you an example of one paper I went to at an international academy conference where a postdoc from Northwestern University, one of the great sex research centres in America, was using MRI scans, excuse me, I've had a cold, so I'm sorry about this, MRI scans to try and track down how arousal, sexual arousal works in the brain. So he injected men with a dye that would show up in the brain when that part of the brain was starting to fire, and then did the MRI scans while they were showing them pornography, the usual kind of thing. They show them pornography to see if they get aroused, right? And as, of course, as they got aroused, the blue dye did go into different parts of the brain. So they could kind of see which bit of the brain was actually part of the biological response to arousal. And arousal here is obviously social because you're looking at a magazine, you know, in some way, but they never think of that. But anyway, it's going on. Well, they really were looking for, is arousal different in homosexual men than heterosexual men? So we're right back to the fundamental moment of the taxonomy of sexology in 1869 when the term is invented. Well, lo and behold, it's the same. Surprise, surprise, that the biology of the brain and the bit that actually has evolved to deal with arousal is exactly the same, no matter what the source of stimulation. And I don't know why they were surprised to find that finding. But for some reason, they thought they would actually find, you know, a little blue light going off on this side of my brain instead of a little blue light going off on this side of my brain because I'm gay rather than straight. But they do, and they're still looking for this. But they have got something going on. They do know in the plasticity argument about neuroscience that the body is deeply implicated in terms of its chemical reactions to arousal, its chemical reactions to the way it triggers mechanisms in the body that turn the inside of those vaginas a different colour and make penises erect. They actually know the body itself has in a sense, a kind of independence in what it's going on, which cannot function without the social around it and stimulating and being part of it. But it's not sitting there as a passive vehicle for sex to operate as a social field, which is how the social sciences have been thinking about it for a long time. So we are really being challenged at the moment by this kind of neuroscience in thinking about the body. And this is coming out of biology, and it's coming out of endocrinology and various other places. And we really have to think hard in the social sciences, where I work, to tackle this stuff and not simply see the body as a vehicle that discourses happen to be written on by the history and culture of sex in the West. The second challenge is coming to the challenge to the main gender binaries, the gender binary of male-female and the sexuality binary for homosexual-heterosexual. And here the challenges are coming from trans politics and from intersex politics and the research endeavours that are related to those politics. And this is a very exciting area where we're seeing dramatic shifts in the way in which we think about the body, we think about sexuality, and we think about gender. And this is not my area of work, but I'm going to actually read a small piece of something that I wrote about this, because that other way I won't get it wrong. Intersex politics is offering a remarkable opportunity to include the biological body in social accounts of gender by refusing sex and gender binaries in favour of a continuum that allows for variability in the body itself, a lack of precision, and the very unpredictability of outcome. As genetics and endocrinology continue to reveal biological aspects to intersex, even within their own problems of taxonomy, the material body is deeply implicated in the production of difference. In this, genetics and endocrinology join with intersex politics and are increasingly challenging social constructionist accounts of their endeavours as just simply discursive manoeuvres, which is how social constructionist accounts have dealt with this kind of science. Here, the body demands priority in its own right. Transgender politics also argues strongly for the intersection of the biological and social bodies, privileging neither one. To complicate the matter, one section of transgender politics refuses all binaries and challenges us to take seriously a fully social constructionist view of the body, while other transgender politics challenges sexual medicine and sexology in their focus purely on the physiological and the psychological. This politics argues for a misalignment of the social and the biological, while relying on surgical and chemical interventions in the biological body to install the social body. The body is deeply implicated in this argument as a pre-discursive phenomenon. In this particular area, we're seeing really complicated and really great advances and fights and arguments between many, many sides of science and academics and politics. And I think I'm just saying right this minute, watch this space. What I mainly want to signal is there's not a lot of sexuality in this stuff. As you saw in the notion of gender identity in the SOGI acronym, it positions all issues to do with trans and intersex as if it's only to do with identity and a gender issue of misalignment or something else shifting and changing. Sexuality as an embodied practice seems quite missing from a lot of this politics. But it's an area that's opening up at the moment, and there's a lot going on. The third problematic area is identity politics. Here we have the alphabet soup. G-L-H-H-B-B-T-T-T-I-Q-Q-A-A. This is as far as I could get this afternoon. Now, what does that stand for? Gay, lesbian, homosexual, heterosexual, bisexual, bicurious, transgender, transsexual, transvestite, intersex, queer, questioning, asexual, and androgyne. What is going on here with this ever-evolving set of differentiations at the level of gender and sexual identities? And why has this particular politics become so dominant in the daily politics, not in the theory necessarily, of sexuality? And where is it going? What does it do when all it does is actually claim a space called diversity? And diversity has no concept of power in it. Diversity just lines up pieces like pawns on a chessboard. They're all equal in strength in the front row. They all do the same thing. I wonder where analyses of power are operating inside this particular kind of identity politics. Where is the question of hierarchy? Where has patriarchy disappeared in all of this? Why is gender and sexuality all confused along that line where some of those things are categories of sexual orientation and others are categories of gender identity and shifts in those things at the same time? What are we producing analytically in this kind of political maneuver in terms of understanding gender and sexuality as two mammoth structures of power operating historically and culturally in our society at the time? A lot of this politics is producing a kind of, if you like, neoliberal subject, as if the individual inside a neoliberal culture like our own can claim a space in the sun for him or herself or their individual being, it lacks the kind of real politics of collective practice. And that's, I think, is a rapid and very different way of working sexual politics than we did in, say, 70s and 80s and the early 90s, when we think about sexual politics in the West in particular. There's also a kind of exercise here in governmentality in which this endless differentiation of identity categories are all saying, me too. I want to belong to your game. So just open up the doors a little wider and all of us can fit in too. And this, of course, is an argument, that a queer argument about the marriage equality debate as well. It becomes a politics of incorporation, of becoming governable in a very deliberate kind of way. And I think that raises really, really, really serious political difficulties, and it raises conceptual and analytical difficulties for us in the field of sexuality studies. It's a very heavily US-influenced politics. And indeed, if you look at the writing coming out of Britain and Australia, this is very heavily US. And when you think about the historical nature and way in which the individual and the notion of individual liberty is totally saturates American culture, theory and ideas, you can see why a kind of politics of endlessly differentiated individual identities has taken off. There's not much of a countervailing discourse at the moment. But there's one, Ken Plummer, who in his latest book, which is Cosmopolitan Sexualities, is attempting to come up with his phrase cosmosexualities, which I quite love, it sounds like a cocktail, with this notion of cosmopolitan sexualities, a way in which he says, how can we connect our differences with collective values, our uniqueness with multiple group belonging, our sexual and gendered individualities within a broader common humanity? So he's kind of drunk the Kool-Aid on governmentality, we're going to be incorporated no matter what. But what might be the way in which, by working in contrast to an individually gendered and sexual identity focused politics, we could produce a new collective politics, which would then reissue the challenge to gender and sexuality as discursive fields of power inside our own societies now, because those systems of power are still operating. So this is a really interesting area of challenge for us. And the last I want to mention is technosexuality. Here, Haraway's cyborg comes to mind yet again, and is still being alive. But mostly in this field, people have mainly been interested in thinking about how people are using technology. How do I use my mobile phone to hook up with somebody on a Saturday night? How do I sext a message to my girlfriend or boyfriend? There's a fairly kind of, I think, real misunderstanding of how technology works in reconstituting sexual subjectivity, which is what it's doing at the moment. How do you actually think about the place of non-human objects and processes in a kind of set of relationships that are shifting our sexual subjectivity away from a sense of identity and away from the categories and pleasures that we're used to? How do you fit in sex toys, chemicals, electronics, teledildonics, and real-time sexual performance in cyberspace and rethink those as actually being constitutive of sexual subjectivity in quite a different way? This is really about recalibrating sexuality away from identities and orientations, and actually thinking about preferences. What are the things we like? What gives us pleasures? What gets the synapses functioning? What makes the dopamine move through the brain and lay down in that neuroplastic space, new pleasures and new ways of thinking about ourselves? How might we overcome this stupid distinction between real-time versus virtual sex, when you think about the connection between bodies and technologies as not being real-time, but they are in fact all embedded in the same set of practices, constituting a sexual subjectivity at the same moment? This really requires us to rethink subjectivity beyond submission to a discourse, which is how it's largely thought about, and think about subjectivity as a set of material practices involving persons, actions, objects, substances, meanings, histories, spaces, processes, and interactions, and all shifts in all of these going on at the same time. So there's the fourth and last challenge I'd leave you with. I've got a sort of little aphorism to finish off with. Societies do not simply construct sexualities. Society itself is actually constructed sexually in the way we interact with each other and the meanings we create and produce as we interact sexually with us and everything else that's involved in our sexual lives, those objects, those substances, those processes. If we can grasp that as the new way forward, we've got another step in the field of the development of sexuality as a conceptual framework with its own legitimacy, and it will bring challenges for gender, new challenges for gender theory, but it will also need to move together with gender theory to move forward on some of the political and theoretical issues that we face. Thank you.
This podcast was recorded by the Gender and Sexuality Interest Group at the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society of La Trobe University. We host regular seminars for postgraduate students and early career researchers who are interested in gender and sexuality. Our primary goal is to foster new ideas and to provide networking opportunities in a friendly and informal environment. To find out more about us, please visit Arches online at latrobe.edu.au/ARCSHS or contact the group at gsig.latrobe@gmail.com.